Good. So a very, very warm welcome on a very cold day to the London Buddhist Centre. Particularly welcome if you've not been here before. I know some of you have been here before. For many of you, it might be your first visit to the centre. My name's Nyan of Archer, and I'm one of the teachers here. I'm actually the chairman of the centre as well. And on the programme, we've billed this hour as an hour on death. A talk on death. So it's lovely to see so many faces. when you kind of compile a programme, you know, a few months in advance, you have to find themes, don't you? And I volunteered to do the talk on death. And one's never quite sure, you know, whether, particularly a lunchtime slot, whether anybody's going to turn up. So it's lovely to see people here. What I suggest we do is... Well, I'll tell you what I'm suggesting, that we'll just sit for a moment or two and I'll lead us in a sort of awareness of the body so that we can just arrive. And then I'll say a few words, but mainly I'd like this to be a relatively sort of interactive, informal hour where we explore the topic of death. I'd like to sort of hear what you want to hear, what thoughts you have, and I'll share some of my own thoughts and reflections and perhaps talk a little bit about what Buddhism has to say about death, a Buddhist perspective on that. Okay. So why don't we just start by sitting as comfortably as you can, and I know that won't be very comfortable for a lot of you, particularly if you've not sat on cushions before. We'll just sit like this for about 3 or 4 minutes, so it won't be very long. And it's just a way to arrive into the space. So if you want to, I'm going to invite you to just close your eyes. If you don't want to, that's fine too. So then just starting by taking a couple of deeper breaths. And particularly as you breathe out, seeing if you can feel the weight of your body against the cushions or the chair and against the ground. See if you can have a sense of that contact with the supports and with the ground. As if you can just let go of the weight of your body. Into the ground. As if your body is breathing a sigh of relief. There's no need to hold on to the weight. Take your attention to your shoulders. Just notice if you're holding on in the shoulders. If you are, see if you can let them go a little bit more. Sense of the arms just hanging from your shoulders. And see if you can bring your awareness into your stomach, into the region around the stomach, in the belly. And just notice the movement in the belly as you breathe. Notice that your body is breathing. What that feels like in the belly. When you feel ready, you can just open your eyes and see if you can maintain some degree of awareness of what it feels like in the belly. Some degree of awareness still in that region of your body. And then just sitting comfortably. So, hi, come on in. There's cushions and things over on the side, so mats in the corner. So just before coming down, I was trying to reflect a little bit on what I'd like to say. And on my bookshelf I noticed a book that I hadn't really looked at in years, and it's a book by Stephen Levine called Who Dies? And he wrote it in the 70s, I think. Quite a popular book in the 70s. And I just opened it up at the beginning and, you know, had a look and saw how he started. And he just said, today, 200,000 people will die. I think he was probably speaking, as I say, in the mid-70s, and actually today, many more 100,000 people will die because our population has grown, probably doubled or tripled since that time. The point he was making is that hundreds of thousands of people all over the world will be dying every day. And we kind of know that. It's a commonplace in a certain sense, and yet it's one of these things that we really don't know. We profoundly look away and refuse to acknowledge most of the time. Of course, some of those people will make the headlines. And some of those deaths will be particularly unexpected or, well, they'll all be tragic in a certain sort of way. But he was trying to make the point that it's not unusual, that we live in this world where we still think of death as some sort of strange catastrophe that occasionally strikes within our sphere of awareness. And that one day it will strike us. We kind of know that at some level, but most of the time we look the other way. And you might say, oh, well, that's fair enough. You might say that's fair enough. I'd say, at least from a Buddhist perspective, that it prevents us from fully living our lives, from fully appreciating what it is to be alive. From a Buddhist perspective, an awareness of the impermanence of life, an awareness that we're mortal, an awareness that death is a certainty, but that the time of death is completely unknown, that sort of awareness makes us more alive, or can make us more alive, can make us appreciate life more. At least that's the theory. So that's what we're going to be, I'm going to be seeing if we can explore a little bit more in the time that we've got. But I thought I'd also just start off by asking, well, we can't all speak, but asking from some of you if you'd like to say, you don't have to, but what your reflection on death is, or what made you come to this talk on death. What made you come here? Because obviously, just by being here, all of us have decided, at least for a little bit of time, we're not going to look away. We're not going to have another drink or have lunch and talk about something else or go shopping. We've decided to spend an hour potentially thinking about death. So it'd be just interesting to hear a few reflections or responses as to what made you do that. And then I'll share some things as well. Yes, over there in the back. Hi.
Yeah, there's nothing's permanent, so we all gonna die one day, so you have to accept it.
Right, yeah. So just like Stephen Levine is sort of saying, that sort of reflection. Yeah. Anybody else? Yeah, sorry, I'll put you in the corner first.
I think for me it's the same, you have to accept it, but at the same time it's a scary thought, so it's about trying to find a way that when it does come, that it doesn't have to be really scary.
So I think that is the crux of it, isn't it? That if we want to, in a way, learn to accept death, and if you accept the fact, or accept the premise that I've tried to outline, which is that it's good to start to accept the fact of death because it can help enhance life. If you accept that, then the question is, well, how do you do that? How do you do that? Yeah. So maybe we'll come on to that.
Since my mother's death 10 months ago, I've obviously been reflecting more on the topic of death.
Yeah.
You know, Western society is shocking that it's only in the last 2 years I first saw a dead body.
Right, yeah.
It's so hidden away.
Yeah.
And when you're brought up against it, was there which in the hospice, it makes you question what you've been spending your life doing.
Yeah.
And the more I've reflected on the purpose of life, the more I've narrowed it down to three things.
Yeah.
Developing wisdom and compassion and preparing well for that last breath.
Yeah, preparing for death, yeah. And you could say that developing wisdom and compassion is part of that preparation.
Indeed.
Yeah. So in a way thank you for that. Thank you for sharing that. I think there's something really true in what you say. You've said several things. One is that in our culture, the sort of facts of death, seeing corpses, etc., is hidden away compared to at least some cultures and traditional societies. If you go to India, it's much more likely that you'll see dead bodies, sometimes even in the streets. So it's hidden away. It's not just hidden away physically, I think it's hidden away at a cultural level, in that we don't think about it, we don't talk about it, and yet we watch all these violent films and things where people are killing each other all the time, but somehow I think even that keeps us at a little distance from the real facts. Yeah. Until a very close loved one, our parents or whoever, dies, and then I think it really makes us think about not just the universality of death, but what are we doing with our lives? What are we doing? Certainly that was my experience when my father died. My father died when I was 11. And my experience was very much, well, as an 11-year-old, I'd never really thought about death, or maybe I had in a sort of gruesome way, the death of dinosaurs and things like that. But I'd not thought that it would happen to me or to anybody I knew. And then he died very suddenly, and it really did change my whole pattern of reflecting. And I believe from that point on, it was a question that was never that far away. I can't even tell you exactly what the question was, but it was something like, well, if this happens, what's life about? What's life about? What are we doing? If this happens, not only if this happens, but if this definitely will happen, what are we doing? What are we doing? And for me, it was very much a case of what are we doing with our lives? What should I be doing with my life if I know that I'm going to die? Because my dad's life even as an 11-year-old, I think I was quite critical of. And his death, I mean, he was only 45, it really didn't make sense of all his anxieties, all his worries about the mortgage, the holiday, could we afford a car, his rowing with my mother about petty things, all of that just didn't make sense. Do you see what I mean? That couldn't have been what life was about if you'd just dropped dead. So I think it's really quite, well, many of us have probably had experiences of close bereavements like that. And I think it's really good to start reflecting on what that means for us. Yeah, gentleman at the back.
I think that the idea of death doesn't bother me in a sense.
Yeah.
What bothers me is that I can't get my head around the idea of not existing anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
Because my knowledge of existence is there is this room.
Yeah.
I can't conceptualise what it would be like to not be here.
Yeah, and we've never known any different, as it were. What would it be like to not be here, to not exist? Maybe I'll say a couple of things about that, and then I'll come round to other people. Let me just say a few things.
I know it's like a jump, usually.
Sure. Maybe I'll just say again what the Buddhist position is about what will happen. The Buddha taught something that is quite difficult to get our heads around. I don't think I've got my head around it. In fact, I don't think you can really understand it. But I'll tell you roughly what he said. So he said, at one extreme, we can believe that after the death of the body, there's nothing. The lights go out, and there's nothing. So the body is all that we are, and the body dies. And that's it. And he, from a Buddhist perspective, he said that that was not how things were. He said that that was a nihilist position and wasn't how things were. Now, he couldn't prove that, and so I'm not suggesting... Buddhism doesn't ask you to kind of believe anything that you can't prove for yourself. I'm just telling you what the Buddha said. So he said it wasn't true, that there wasn't anything after death. But then he said that there's this other position, another extreme, which is some sort of eternal life after death in some sort of realm, be that a heavenly realm or a hellish realm or something in between. Some sort of eternal existence, just as we are. And he said, well, that was another extreme, and it was also not how things were. From a Buddhist position, both that nihilist position and that eternalist position are sort of half true, but they both get it, they both throw too far. What the Buddha said is that there is something that continues of consciousness after death. But that whatever it is that continues isn't a fixed entity, it's not an unchanging entity. And it's never going to just be static and living in an eternal kind of realm. What the Buddha is saying is that actually what we are is a flowing process of consciousness and physical processes sort of combined. We're a process that's always changing. And from a Buddhist perspective, death is some sort of transition where some sort of part of consciousness continues, but continues to change. Just as I'm not the man, I'm not the person now, the same person as I was as that 11-year-old kid, and yet there's continuity. I sort of am the same, and yet I'm not the same person. What the Buddha would say is that something continues, but it's not the same. There's some sort of process that's changing all the time. Now, my own teacher, Sangharakshita, sort of says, you know, perhaps a more pragmatic way, that you don't have to believe any of that in order to practice Buddhism. All you have to think about is, what do I want to do with my life? And see if the practices of Buddhism help you live a more fulfilled life? So, famously, when he was asked by somebody, he's still alive, by the way, he's 87, going on 88, and he was asked by somebody, what happens after death? And in his rather sort of sardonic and challenging way, he just looked at them, pointed his finger and said, you will soon find out. And so he doesn't particularly hold that we have to believe a particular position. But what is important from a Buddhist perspective is, well, what are we doing with our lives? And the views that we hold about what will happen after death can have a bearing on how we live our lives. And I think that that is important. Yeah. So, for example, what the Buddha said is that if you hold a nihilistic perspective, like this life is all there is, the lights go out, that's it, then one conclusion that you might come to that is very commonplace is that all that there is to do in life is to maximise pleasure and happiness while you've got the chance. Eat, drink and be merry now, because tomorrow we die. And what he said is that that leads to a sort of hedonistic lifestyle that is ultimately very unfulfilling. And I think in our culture, that hedonism is represented by our, well, mass consumerism. Our shopping has become the religion, hasn't it, that has replaced any kind of collective practice. That's what we do at the weekend. For millions of people anyway, that's what you do. You go shopping. So it's what do we do with our lives and how that might be influenced by what we believe about death that I think is worth asking. The other extreme, eternalism, he also sort of condemned and said, well, what that means, if you're of an eternalist bent, he said that the tendency can be to think that the real deal will happen after death. That's when eternal life will open up. And so then you sort of don't make the most of your life here and now. You live for some sort of future afterlife, which, you know, is also not very wise from a Buddhist perspective. So I saw a couple of hands that were raised earlier. If you'd raised your hand earlier, I'd raise it again. And I saw you first, and I'll come to you. Yeah.
How about the reincarnation? I know it's a different topic, but
it's linked, isn't it?
Buddhist belief in
that. Yeah. So, the Buddha did believe, Buddhists do tend to believe, that after death something continues of consciousness and that that will then eventually take on another birth. It's a bit different to how reincarnation is understood in Hinduism, for example. In Hinduism, it's understood as if we really do have some essential soul that is released from the body at death and then finds another body. An analogy that's used often is like putting on a new suit of clothes. You put on a new form, a body. Whereas the Buddhist position is that we don't have this fixed essential bit of ourselves that is unchanging. An analogy that's often used is imagine lighting one candle with the flame of another candle. There's some sort of continuity, but it's not the same flame. And yet, there was continuity. So, what Buddhism talks about is often termed as rebirth rather than reincarnation, to make that distinction between a fixed and essential soul and something that's more fluid, a process that seems to continue, but that isn't the same.
So, whatever you achieve in this life, the progress in the soul, does it affect you when you rebirth, or?
Yeah, in a way that brings us on to the whole notion of karma, doesn't it? I think, again, what the Buddha said is that what seems to continue is aspects of our character. And if we've lived a life that is, altruistic, kind, generous, outward facing, as it were, then those qualities of our being will carry on. Similarly, if we've lived a life that's very self-oriented, that character trait will carry on. So yeah, our qualities somehow carry on. That's the position.
Do you mean through other people that we know?
Well, partly that. And I know some Buddhists who primarily think in those terms, that we've affected the world through our lives and our actions. Those people will then go on to affect the world through their lives and actions. Like a ripple effect, we have an effect on the wider world. And I think that's a valid way of looking at it. But traditionally, Buddhists would see it in, as well as that, that there was something personal that carried on and then took on a new life. And that's more unprovable. And Buddhism doesn't quite believe in, well, it doesn't believe in dogma. It doesn't say that you have to take on anything on blind faith. So from a Buddhist perspective, this is what the Buddha said, but you don't have to believe it to be Buddhist, if you see what I mean. Do you see what I mean? Yeah. Buddhism doesn't have any dogma. But that's what the tradition would say. What I would say is, whatever you believe, question it. Because actually we don't know. Really, we just do not know, do we? If we're going to be really, really empirical and rational about it, we don't really know. We don't really know whether death means the end and the lights go out. We don't know if we're going to go to some sort of heaven or other place. We don't know if the Buddhist position of some sort of continuity of birth and death and birth and death is true. We don't really know. What is very common in our culture is a thought that we do know. I think that's just kidding ourselves. We don't really know. We don't really know. Yeah.
You say you don't know, but what if somebody's achieved stream entry, or non-returning, or once returning?
Yeah.
Then obviously they do know because they've had
some sort of experience,
some level of awakening, yeah, or Buddhist, yeah, enlightenment. Yeah. Then they do know. So.
Yeah. I think that's right, but perhaps I should qualify that. Individuals might feel that they know. So if as an individual, you've had some sort of transcendental insight, then you might actually know. I've met people who have memories of past lives. I don't, but for them, those memories are real enough to convince them that they know that they have had a past life. What they can't do from that individual basis is convince others.
Yeah.
You can't make a rational case that says, okay, I know, and therefore you must believe me.
Yeah, sure.
So you can't necessarily do that. But individuals obviously will have their convictions. But somebody could always come along to them and say, well, you're just deluded, mate. Mm-hmm. And then what do you do? Yeah. Yeah, you've been waiting, haven't you?
I just wanted to go back to we sort of started with a very abstract idea of death, and to know that millions of people around the world die. And then we've heard some personal revelations of people's death. And at what point is death? Like, this sort of thing, I sort of thought, it's just going to be like a big abstract thing about what happens after we die. Like, in a way, like, that doesn't make any difference to me whatsoever. What seems to matter is seeing how people cope with it, the loss.
Yeah.
I'd rather not talk about, we can talk about all sorts of things, but I'd rather not talk about death like someone read it in a book.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's abstract.
Yeah.
Because it's not, because it's a very personal experience.
Yeah.
As you clearly have shared. And the ones I've experienced, I feel like because I didn't see, that evidence that some people have seen, but it's personal. I feel like I'm caught somewhere in the middle between knowing that, yeah, lots of people are born,
yeah,
and lots of people die.
Yeah.
Someone dies close to you.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily care about my own death. And yeah. I'm not afraid of what happens, and if I come and go, I don't really mind. But how do you help other people cope
yeah.
with death?
Yeah, with bereavement.
Not the bereavement part of it. I mean, the concept of death. I know this is what you're talking about. This isn't about bereavement, but bereavement is the real experience of death, not something someone can write an essay on about how many people die in the world. Numbers that really count for until you see someone that you love and they're gone, or you see someone who has lost someone. How do you help them? I mean, where's the answer in loss? I mean, what is that loss? I mean, what are we losing? Like, if we're so afraid of death, I'm not sure that's what it is that we feel when we lose someone. It's like you lose that person, but how do you get over that? What's the answer? Not that there's an answer, but how do you prepare others dealing with loss? I don't know what I'm trying to say.
No, I think I'm really glad that you've raised this, because I think bereavement is probably something that most of us, if we haven't already experienced, will experience. And in a way, that's the closest we'll come to death before our own death. Yeah? And in a certain sense, that's what we'll have to deal with in life, is that sort of loss. Our own death will be gone, in a way. Maybe we won't have to deal with it in a certain sense. So I think it's a really good point. I'd sort of come back to Paul. I think my own experience is that it's only when I've suffered a bereavement that in a way I've had to kind of make sense of, or try to make sense of, what I'm doing with my life. So recently, for example, my mother died. Well, she died over a year ago now, so it's about 14 months ago. And it was a very, very different experience for me to when my dad had died over 30 years ago. And I think one of the differences for me was that I've been meditating for a number of years and reflecting on what life is about. One of the differences was also that she had also been meditating for a number of years, for about 30 years, and she was able to, by the time death happened, even though it was relatively sudden, she was able to let go very quickly. The consequences of that, her being able to let go very quickly and me having a meditation practice that had, I don't know, just prepared me to stay. One of the things with meditation is that I think it's helped me stay with difficult emotion without trying to push it away and pretend it's not happening, or without getting swamped in it and overwhelmed by it. And those two extremes are very easy to fall into around the point of bereavement. Sorry, go on.
Oh, no, I'm sorry to refer back to you, but how did you find coping as a boy? As an adult, you can get your head around things, but as a child, did you have people that?
I guess I was quite fortunate in that I had a lot of adults around me that showed me a lot of love, and also as a boy, possibly. I mean, it's difficult to remember quite, but I think kids can be quite resilient in that they can get on with whatever's next in their life. They can sort of be easily distracted. But I think one of the things that, as I say, it left me as a boy was this questioning, which was, in retrospect, a positive questioning. But as an adult, I've got more resources. And I think meditation is a really, really, really valuable resource. It might be bereavement, it might be other crises in our lives, it's very, very, as I say, common to either push them away and pretend they're not happening, or to get swamped in them. And meditation is one fruit of practice, meditation practice, is that we're able to hold those emotions more with greater equanimity, but without cutting off from them. Because one of the real opportunities of death, bereavement anyway, is that we can open our hearts. Yeah? Often we go around and we're closed. We go around, in London perhaps particularly, sort of being closed to other people, even to friends and lovers and loved ones. We're not fully open. One of the things, the gifts of death, as it were, is that it opens our hearts up. And that can be really, really precious. My own experience of bereavement, and I don't want to generalise about this because everybody's going to be different, but my own experience, particularly my mother's death, was that there was a lot of beauty and joy and love and richness in the time following her death. I was watching, this is slightly different, this is a man talking about his own imminent death. I've forgotten her name. Somebody will remind me in a minute. Byron Katie, who does... She's a sort of particular type of therapist who's developed her own form of therapy. And one of the things she does... you'll see the connection in a minute. One of the things she does is gets people to question their assumptions about what's happening in their life. So you can go to her and say, my life's falling apart. And she'll say, now there's some good in that. What do you think's good that's happening? Yeah? Turn it around. Rather than say it's falling apart, can you frame it in a positive way? Anyway, you can look at this clip on YouTube probably. She's interviewing a man who's got terminal cancer. And he's agreed to be filmed in this therapy session, as it were. I can't remember it completely. But she says to him, he's married, he's got family, he's got kids, he's going to die. And he says, you know, that he just wishes that they could just remove this tumour and it would go away. It would just leave him. And she says, give me a reason why it's a good thing that the tumour's not going to go away. When the doctors tell you that it's not going to go away. Tell me why that might be a good thing. And he sort of, you know, has to really pause, and then he says something about, well, it's made him really appreciate what's important in his life now. And she said, that's good. And she said, tell me another. And he says, well, you know, I can't remember actually, but something about perhaps he's become closer to his kids. And she says, that's really good. You know, tell me another. And eventually he says something about his heart is opened up. It's sort of probably been broken open. And he feels more connected with life and the world around him than he's ever done before. And she says, that's great. And there's more. And then she says, learn to meditate. It's a really courageous... encounter, both her being courageous enough to confront this man with the reality of his situation in a very kindly but very challenging way, and really courageous of him to go with that and to be completely honest. And what comes out is, he's weeping by the end, but it's a very, very different atmosphere to somebody saying, why is this happening to me? So in that, I think there's a clue to how do we ideally meet bereavement, how do we meet the knowledge of our own death. There's something about, can we learn to open our hearts? Can we have the courage to do that? And if we can, I think we find that we're more alive. Dennis Potter did that, didn't he? Do you remember the interview with Dennis Potter? I often quote it. He was dying again of cancer. He's being interviewed on the telly by Melvin Bragg on the South Bank show. And he's talking about sitting at his desk. Dennis Potter was a playwright, writer. He's sitting at his desk and he says he looks out of the window and it's springtime and the cherry tree is in bloom. And he says, looking at that blossom, it was the blossomiest blossom that he'd ever seen in his life. And of course it was, because he knew that he'd never see another spring. He knew that this was a rare sight now for him. And what it does is it heightens your awareness. And he said that he'd never felt so alive. As he's in this interview, he's having to drink morphine to control himself. He didn't have long to live. I think he died weeks after. So all I'm saying is that you don't have to, from a Buddhist perspective, you can prepare for death by learning to really live life. And part of that is opening our hearts. And part of that is learning to stay with a difficult experience without getting swamped, without getting distracting ourselves. Yes?
I just wanted to come in just briefly. You were talking about grief as a child. My mum died when I was 12, and I think sometimes when you're that young, even if we're only children, they often just don't really realise the full impact. You're too young to see.
Yes.
You just don't know.
That's right.
And also something about fairness, because my dad lived 45 years longer. Oh. So it's
that sort
of fairness of where she plucked out at 40, and he was 85 plus. And I nursed all of my life, so I've seen babies and I've seen adults.
Yeah.
Also, I think the thing that freaks me out is the sudden, unexpected instances now, like that pilot.
Yeah.
During the week.
Yeah.
Going to work and all the day.
Yeah. Yeah.
The guy.
That's right.
On the ground as well,
right.
Going to work. He was early that day, otherwise he would have, he'd be still around.
That's right.
That's the bit that sort of scares.
Yeah.
And I think if you get to about 90, you think, well, they've had their time, they've achieved it in terms of, they might have tragic things happening and stuff like that. Maybe you can say it was, you know, really happy ever after.
Yeah.
But they've not been cheated of time.
Yeah, I think both those points are just, I mean, there's no answer, but there's something very important to make about them. One is the sheer unfairness, or what feels like unfairness. And I think particularly when people die young, or they die in accidents, or you know, life is cut short so dramatically. I'm not a parent, but I can't imagine the pain that a parent who's lost their child must feel, for example. That feels very, it's cruel, it just feels very cruel, doesn't it? And then there's the literal unknowingness, the suddenness, the unexpectedness. We really don't know whether we're going to, see tomorrow or not. And yet we go about it as if we've got forever. And again, there needs to be a happy medium. If we were going around in an anxious way, thinking, my goodness, I might die now, that can't be the way to live. So I've known somebody like that who was constantly thinking he was having a heart attack and sort of refused to go upstairs and things like that because it might strain his heart. So that can't be the way to live. On the other hand, to never reflect on the fact that we don't know how long we've got, can't be a way to live either. I think with the sort of unfairness, the fact that I really don't think anything kind of makes it all right. I don't think any religion that tries to sort of make it all right, or any faith system, or any kind of belief that makes that all right, for me, anyway, that doesn't ring true. It's not all right. To pretend that it is all right is to be pretending, actually. it's not all right. Life isn't all right in that sense. It can be incredibly cruel, and pain, and it's shot through with pain even when it isn't incredibly cruel. Even if we do live to 90 and live a good life, there'll be pain. From a Buddhist perspective, no, it's not all right. And there are ways of living that make it richer and make it worthwhile to be alive. It doesn't take all that pain away and turn it into some Disneyland world, but it does make it real and meaningful, even joyous. And it can be. It can be. Yeah.
Why do you think it is that it takes, for familiar people, it takes death or impending death for them to, for example, see that blossom as the most blossomy blossom of all, rather than to see that, as to experience a blossom in that way,
yeah,
without the threat of death?
Yeah. I think there are two reasons. Did everybody hear that? The gentleman was asking, why do you think, he's asking me, why do I think that for most people it takes something like bereavement or death to make them see that blossomiest blossom as the blossomiest blossom, as it were? Why is that? And I think that there are several reasons. One is the nature of our own consciousness, the nature of our own mind. What we're doing is we're constantly grasping and protecting our sense of our own ego identity. To see the blossom as the blossomiest blossom, it's like we've got to open our hearts and for a while forget ourselves. And then it's almost like a mystical encounter with the world. And we realise that it's alive as we are and we're connected. And then we have this experience of wonder and beauty. But for most of the time, what we're doing is we're living in a much more egocentric, narrow way that says, how can I get what I want for me? Yeah. So if I'm constantly thinking about how can I get what I need for me or want for me, I'm never going to even notice the cherry blossom because I'm going to be too worried about the iPad 3 that I want or the next car or the next holiday or the next lover or the next house. Or do you see what I mean? We live in this egocentric, grabby kind of way. That's the way consciousness is. And therefore we lose out on that experience of transcendent wonder and beauty. And then the other thing is that our culture around us, and particularly our Western society, reinforces that tendency that we already have in our consciousness and keeps telling us, oh yeah, the way to be happy is to acquire more, to shop more, to consume more, to get more, and then we'll be fulfilled. So it keeps telling us that every time we, you know, see an advert, every time we see a poster, every time we see a film, it keeps saying that, yeah, just grabbing at more. And I'm not saying that those things don't bring some sort of pleasure. They do. Yeah, they do. I'm not saying they're bad. Buddhism doesn't think it's sinful to, you know, have a lover or a house or a nice iPad 3 even. It's not that. What it's saying is that if you think that that is all there is to life and that's where meaning and real fulfillment is to be found, then you're missing out. Then you're missing out. That's not what we need to live for. Whereas so many of us do live for those things, and our culture around us tells us that's the way to happiness. And then it's only when we're caught short, as it were, by somebody dying, that it really doesn't make sense. We see the hollowness of that story. I'm just going to take one more. There's somebody caught my eye here, and then we must wrap up. No, if there isn't, then go ahead.
Oh, sorry, yeah, just one more thing. This reminds me of what the lady said in the previous session about having a fixed goal,
yeah,
and trying to attain it,
yeah,
won't bring you true,
yeah,
happiness,
yeah,
because you force your way through to get those things, you step,
yeah,
on things on the way.
Yeah.
So it sounds like if we think that a human life should last 85 or 90 years, and that's a fixed goal.
It is.
I mean, if people don't reach that, then you can say that a tragedy.
That's right.
Amongst other things, out of all the children my mother had, she lost one and a half years, 18 months. I mean, how short is that?
Yeah.
An 18-month-old, I mean, who'd want to lose that? But next year she had another child, and she had children after that, and the rest of the family wasn't the same, and her approach to the children wasn't the same. And it was like a message. It was like, well, this is what I got from it anyway. That was, he had a valuable life for that short period of time, and it gave him a different way of looking at things, which they never would have had before.
Sure.
Now, 18 months, that's pretty short.
Yeah.
We all think we're going to, well, not, I don't know if we all think this, but we all think we're going to get to 85 or 90, don't we? If we lose someone at 60 or 70, we still think that's short change, don't we?
Sure.
And that's retirement age, this day and age.
So I think you're right. Several things you've said. One is our ideas about those fixed ideas, expectations about life, actually are part of what causes the suffering. When those expectations are not met, and life doesn't feel obliged to meet our expectations, it seems. If it did, then things would be very different. But life does its own thing. So our expectations are our expectations. This is what Byron Katie is doing in her work. She's sort of overturning expectations. Or trying to. This is what Buddhism does. It says, look at your own mind, look at your expectations, look at whether those expectations and stories are bringing you happiness or causing you more pain. Every time we say, this shouldn't happen to me, this is unfair, what's happening is that an expectation is being betrayed. Yeah? Life will betray those. All that we've got is, do we want to cling to that expectation and feel more and more betrayed, or can we change our whole approach, which is much, much harder? So I'm going to leave it there. I just want to say thank you very, very much. I particularly appreciated those of you who shared and asked questions. And thank you for staying with us. And I really hope you have a good rest of the day here.